Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
There are other poems by other poets that I know by heart, but I think I have one of mine, and I'm trying to practice saying it. It's a poem that I learned because I read it. I seem to read it first at many readings, and then most, and then all readings that I gave. It's called "The Missing Boy" for Eitan Peitz. Every time we take the bus, my son sees the picture of the missing boy. He looks at it like a mirror, the dark blonde hair, the blue eyes, the pale skin, the electric blue sneakers with slashes of jagged gold. But of course, that kid is little, only 6 1/2, an age when things can happen to you when you're not really safe. And our son is 7, practically fully grown. Why, he would tower over that kid if they could find him and bring him right here on this bus and stand them together. He sways in the silence, wishing for that. The tape on the poster gleaming over his head, beginning to melt at the center and curl at the edges as it ages. At night, when I put him to bed, my son holds my hand tight and says he's sure that kid's all right, nothing to worry about. He just hopes he's getting the food he likes, not just any old food, but the food he likes the most, the food he is used to. And this is also from The Dead and the Living, a couple of pages later. This is called "The One Girl at the Boy's Party." When I take our girl to the swimming party, I set her down among the boys. They tower and bristle. She stands there smooth and sleek, her math scores unfolding in the air around her. They will strip to their suits, her body hard and indivisible as a prime number. They'll plunge in the deep end. She'll subtract her height from 10 feet, divide it into hundreds of gallons of water, the numbers bouncing in her mind like molecules of chlorine in the bright blue pool. When they climb out, her ponytail will hang its pencil lead down her back. Her narrow silk suit with hamburgers and French fries printed on it will glisten in the brilliant air, and they will see her sweet face, solemn and sealed, a factor of one, and she will see their eyes, 2 each, their legs, 2 each, and the curves of their sexes, 1 each, and in her head she'll be doing her wild multiplying as the drops sparkle and fall to the power of 1,000 from her body. I remember when I would first send out poems that were about children, sometimes it would seem to me that they would come back. I would go to the post office and mail them, and then I'd go back home, and in my mailbox would be the rejection slip for for those poems. And there were varying degrees of kindness and sympathy for my lack of understanding about the proper subjects for poetry. And when I see the new generations come along, I know that I, too, will probably not know what they will be doing or what is to be done. Next, occasionally, the Ladies' Home Journal was suggested, which has, of course, a circulation that puts any poetry magazine to great shame. And this was some time ago, so at that time I was eager to consider a variety of possibilities. And the world, of course, that was all, of course, very long ago before we solved those. Before we made progress, before we made some progress. So. some things. This is called I Go Back to May, 1937. I see them standing at the formal gates of their colleges. I see my father strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch, the red tiles glinting like bent plates of blood behind his head. I see my mother with a few light books at her hip, standing at the pillar made of tiny bricks, with the wrought iron gate still open behind her, its sword tips black in the May air. They are about to graduate. They are about to get married. They're kids. They're dumb. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, stop, don't do it. She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do. You are going to do bad things to children. You are going to suffer in ways you have not heard of. You are going to want to die. I want to go up to them there in the late May sunlight and say it. Her hungry, pretty, blank face turning to me, her pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. His arrogant, handsome face turning to me, his pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. But I don't do it. I want to live. I take them up like the male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips like chips of flint as if to strike sparks from them. I say, do what you are going to do, and I will tell about it. Topography. After we flew across the country, we got in bed, laid our bodies delicately together like maps laid face to face, east to west. My San Francisco against your New York, your Fire Island against my Sonoma, my New Orleans deep in your Texas, your Idaho bright on my Great Lakes, my Kansas burning against your Kansas burning against my Kansas, your Eastern Standard Time pressing into my Pacific Time, my Mountain Time beating against your Central Time, your sun rising swiftly from the right, my sun rising swiftly from the left, your moon rising slowly from the left, my moon rising slowly from the right, until all four bodies of the sky burn above us, sealing us together. All our cities, twin cities. All our states united. One nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I was looking for a flag to... In that poem, it seems kind of clearer to me that many of us want to speak as poets with an eye because that's all we've got. But it's not meant to be or hope to be an exclusive eye in a way. And our experiences differ as lovers, they differ as children, they differ in many, many ways. And yet, I would think that it would be our dream to speak to each other. And when I read your poem, for you to be speaking not just to me, but for me in a way. I used to worry a lot about that eye, as if I didn't see how other poets could do what they did without it. I didn't understand that. But I no longer feel that I wish to work always against that, but rather to understand that it's a kind of different craft, perhaps, as well as indicating immaturity or whatever it is it indicates. I'd like to read... Oh, you know what I want to read? I want to read The Blue Dress. I want to read another from The Gold Cell. Where are you? Huh. Oh, yeah. Sorry. 38. Good. The Blue Dress. The first November after the divorce, there was a box from my father on my birthday. No card. but a big box from Hinks, the dark department store with a balcony and mahogany rail around the balcony. You could stand and press your forehead against it until you could almost feel the dense grain of the wood and stare down into the rows and rows of camisoles, petticoats, bras, as if looking down into the lives of women. The box was from there. He had braved that place for me, the way he had entered my mother once to get me out. I opened the box. I had never had a present from him. And there was a blue shirt waist dress, blue as the side of a blue teal, disguised to go in safety on the steel blue water. I put it on, a perfect fit. I liked that it was not too sexy, just a blue dress for a 14-year-old daughter. The way Clark Kent's suit was just a plain suit for a reporter. But I felt the weave of that mercerized Indian head cotton against the skin of my upper arms and my back, and especially the skin of my ribs under those new breasts I had raised in the night like earthworks in commemoration of his name. A year later, during a fight about just how awful my father had been, my mother said he had not picked out the dress, just told her to get something not too expensive, and then had not even sent a check for it. That's the kind of man he was. So I never wore it again in her sight. But when I went away to boarding school, I wore it all the time there, loving the feel of it, just casually mentioning sometimes it was a gift from my father, wanting in those days to appear to have something, whether it was true or a lie, I didn't care, just to have something. It reminds me of some poems I had with me I was reading today. I'd like to read a couple of Lucille Clifton poems. Lucille Clifton is a poet I'm reading a lot these days, and this one is dedicated to Clark Kent. So I thought, Lucille Clifton, If I Should, to Clark Kent. If I should enter the darkest room in my house and speak with my own voice at last about its awful furniture, pulling apart the covering over the dusty bodies, the randy father, the husband holding ice in his hand like a blessing, the mother bleeding into herself, and the small imploding girl. I say, if I should walk into that web, who will come flying after me, leaping tall buildings? You? I'd like to read one more Lucille Clifton poem that's kind of another side of that. This one is called Wishes for Sons. I wish them cramps. I wish them a strange town and the last tampon. I wish them no 7-Eleven. I wish them 1 week early and wearing a white skirt. I wish them 1 week late. Later, I wish them hot flashes and clots like you wouldn't believe. Let the flashes come when they meet someone special. Let the clots come when they want to. Let them think they have accepted arrogance in the universe. Then bring them to gynecologists not unlike themselves. Lucille Clifton. Lucille Clifton has also just a great variety of poems. And one of the reasons I'm so comfortable with these poems of hers, lots of poems very friendly to men, and so with her great heart, she can then turn and say these things in this poem that I haven't seen anyone else say in a poem. I'd like to read a few poems from my book, The Father. This book is a sequence of poems from the point of view of a daughter, embodying the illness and death of a father. And this is called The Look. When my father started choking again, he cried out, "Back rub," in a monotone, as if making an announcement. This man who had never asked me for anything. He was too weak to lean forward much, so I slid my hand between his hot back and the hot sheet, and he sat there with his eyes bulging, those used India ink eraser eyes that had never really looked at me. His skin shocked me, silky as a breast, voluptuous as a baby's skin, but dry, and my hand was dry, so I rubbed easily in circles. He stared and did not choke. I closed my eyes and rubbed as if his body were his soul. I could feel his backbone deep inside. I could feel him under the rule of the choking. All my life I had felt he was under a rule. He gargled. I got the cup ready. I didn't vary the stroke. He spat. I praised him. I let the full pleasure of caressing my father come awake in my body, and then I could touch him from deep in my heart. He shifted in the bed. He tilted. His eyes bugged out and darkened. The mucus rose. I held the cup to his lips, and he slid out the mass and sat back. A flush came into his skin, and he lifted his head shyly but without reluctance and looked at me directly for just a moment with a dark face and dark, shining, confiding eyes. And this is a poem from right in the middle of the book. It's called The Race. When I got to the airport, I rushed up to the desk, bought a ticket. 10 minutes later, they told me the flight was canceled. The doctors had said my father would not live through the night, and the flight was canceled. A young man with a dark blonde mustache told me another airline had a nonstop leaving in 7 minutes. "See that elevator over there? Well, go down to the first floor, make a right. You'll see a yellow bus. Get off at the second Pan Am terminal." I ran. I, who have no sense of direction, raced exactly where he'd told me, a fish slipping upstream deftly against the flow of the river. I jumped off that bus with those bags I had thrown everything into in 5 minutes and ran. The bags wagged me from side to side as if to prove I was under the claims of the material. I ran up to a man with a white flower on his breast. I, who always go to the end of the line, I said, "Help me." He looked at my ticket. He said, "Make a left and then a right. Go up the moving stairs and then run." I lumbered up the moving stairs. At the top, I saw the corridor, and then I took a deep breath. I said goodbye to my body, goodbye to comfort. I used my legs and heart as if I would gladly use them up for this, to touch him again in this life. I ran, and the bags banged me, wheeled and coursed in skewed orbits. I have seen pictures of women running, their belongings tied in scarves grasped in their fists. I blessed my long legs he gave me. My strong heart I abandoned to its own purpose. I ran to gate 17, and they were just lifting the thick white lozenge of the door to fit it into the socket of the plane. Like the one who is not too rich, I turned sideways and slipped through the needle's eye, and then I walked down the aisle toward my father. The jet was full, and people's hair was shining. They were smiling. The interior of the plane was filled with a mist of gold endorphin light. I wept as people weep when they enter heaven in massive relief. We lifted up gently from one tip of the continent and did not stop until we sat down lightly on the other edge. I walked into his room and watched his chest rise slowly and sink again. All night, I watched him breathe. Beyond Harm. A week after my father died, suddenly I understood his fondness for me was safe. Nothing could touch it. In that last year, his face would sometimes brighten when I would enter the room, and his wife said that once, when he was half asleep, he smiled when she said my name. He respected my spunk. When they tied me to the chair that time, they were tying up someone he respected, and when he did not speak for weeks, I was one of the beings to whom he was not speaking, someone with a place in his life. The last week, he even said it once, by mistake. I walked into his room and said, "How are you?" And he said, "I love you too." From then on, I had that word to lose. Right up to the last moment, I could make some mistake, offend him, and with one of his old mouths of disgust, he could re-skew my life. I did not think of it much. I was helping to take care of him, wiping his face and watching him. But then, a while after he died, I suddenly thought, with amazement, he will always love me now, and I laughed. He was dead, dead. The underlife. Waiting for the subway, looking down into the pit where the train rides, I see a section of gray rail detach itself and move along the packed silt. It is the first rat I have seen in years. At first I draw back, but then I think of our son's mice and lean forward. The rat is small, ash gray, silvery, filth fluffy. You can see light through the ears. It moves along the rail. It looks cautious, domestic, innocent. Back home, sitting on the bed, I see an amber lozenge in the sheet's pattern begin to move. And of course, it's a cockroach. It has lived in all the other great cities before their raising and after it. "Christ, you guys," I address these creatures. I know about the plates of the earth shifting over the liquid core. I watched the bourbon and then the cancer pull my father under. I know all this. And the roach and rat turn to me with that swiveling turn of natural animals, and they say to me, "We are not educators. We come to you from him." I often think of the relationship between our lives and the poems we write, and someone handed me this book called Through the Dark Light that's written by children. And because of some of the themes of the father, I thought I'd read three short poems from this book. It's a Poets in the Schools book, poets who go into the schools and teach, and this is a particular program for children who are seen perhaps to be at risk because of a drug addiction or alcohol addiction in the home. And I wanted to read you just a few of these poems. They're just with first names, so I don't know the last name of the poets. But this is by Janine. This is Janine's poem, "I Seem to Be a Lizard." "I seem to be a lizard, but I'm really a fish swimming in a tiny pond. I seem to be a turtle, but I am a snake moving on the ground. I seem to be a nice cat, but I am a mean dog. I feel like a mean, terrible dog and a soft, puffy cat on the outside." That's Janine. That's Janine's poem. And this is Angelo's poem called "He Is the One." "There is the one I need to share my humble feelings. This is the one who throws a ball at me when I'm playing baseball. This is the one who's going to cry for my life when I am put in the coffin. This is the one I can't live without when he dies. And if he might die, may God help him with his problems." There's Angelo. They're about 8 years old. these poets. And this is the last one in the book. This is Kevin. Conversation between the face and heart. Heart, become soft. Face, become caring. Heart, never die. Face, never drink. Face, protect yourself. Heart, protect your blood. Heart, provide enough blood. Face, provide love. That's Kevin. I always feel very much the blessing of those poems. I used to try to decide if the human race was it 90% bad and 10% good, or, you know, then I get down to 80, 70, and then I realized, of course, for us to still be here, it had to be at least 51 good, 51% good. When I read these poems, I think, oh, I've been looking at this the wrong way. And I'd like to read some poems of mine that are newer than poems in books. This is called More Blessed. When the flight attendant offers me coffee, I offer him extra strength Bufferin, which I'm tapping into my palm. No, he smiles. You wouldn't have any Sudafed. Of course I have Sudafed, I exclaim loudly. What I mean is I have what he needs. I am a mother. We discuss his dose. I think if he's used to two, he should stay with two. Can I give you a complimentary Bailey's in that coffee? Oh, no, I say, thanks. As if I would shift this new balance of payments in the universe. It is love, nothing. And the pills were in a packet. The silver bubbles Sudafed come in, so he didn't have to worry about my germs. Suddenly, I realize my mother taught me the bliss of giving. She trained me in it. The way one might become wise with a lover in the bliss of loving. She so loved to receive. She was so grateful for it. Her father must have given her things before his early death, because she claps her little hands and yodels and twinkles. Every gift is erotic. The pleasure of giving is a sexual pleasure. It is a power. I have it. And this is by a special request of Martha's that I'm very honored to say yes to by reading this poem called First Weeks. Those first weeks, I don't know if I loved our daughter. Her face looked crushed, crumpled with worry. And not even despair, but just depression, a look of endurance. The skin of her face was softly wrinkled. There was hair on her ears. She looked a little like a squirrel, suspicious, tranced, and smallish, 7 pounds, wizened. She looked as if she were wincing away from me without moving. The first moment I had seen her, my glasses off in the birth room, a blur of blood and bluish skin and limbs, I had known her, upside down. They righted her, and I heard that faint sexual wail, and her whole body flushed rose. When I saw her next, she was bound in cotton. Someone else had cleaned her, wiped the inside of my body off her, and combed her hair in little scary plow lines. She was 10 days early, sleepy, the breast so engorged it stood out nearly even with the nipple. Her lips would so much as touch the breast, it would hiss and spray. Finally, we took her home. She shrieked and whimpered, a little like a burn victim. And when she was quiet, she would lie there and peer, not quite anxiously. I didn't blame her. She had come to my mother's daughter. I would kneel and gaze at her and pity her. All day I nursed her. All night I walked her and slept and nursed and walked her. And then, one day, she looked at me as if she knew me. She lay along my forearm, fed, and gazed at me as if remembering me, as if she had known me and loved me and was getting her memory back. When she smiled at me, rictus, like birth pain or the agony of coming, I fell in love. I became human. I don't think it was the last time that I voted, but the time before that, that there was a new symbol in the voting booth, which I had never seen before. And as often happens with me, something like that will stay with me and stay with me. And it may take me weeks to understand that rather than getting to be a worse obsessive person, that that's a first line that is going in my mind over and over again. So this poem started from this little symbol above the column that is named different things depending on what our feelings are about its beliefs. It's called "The Fetus in the Voting Booth." When I swung the lever over and the curtain slammed shut and I looked up, there it was, tiny, oval, a paper cocoon spun above the levers, as if I were not the only living thing in there. For a moment, I felt I could almost understand following the leader of the embryo. Its huge, unvarious head, its messy beauty, the meteor tail of its body, its rushing in place, I could almost take it for my God. But to make others take it, to sacrifice them to it, it looked archaic, its white and black like the markings on the torso of a sphinx moth. As I glanced from candidate to candidate, in the corner of my eye, the fetus looked like an eye with an uneven iris, and its gaze seemed to be following me. I thought that I was supposed to be alone in the booth, the way a woman is supposed to be alone with her body. She does not have to give it to anyone anymore, not even a member of her own species, not even a conceived one of her own body. A man has gone up the road of the air and walked on the moon. A woman has gone up the passage of her body to the rosy attic of the womb with her whisk broom weeping or singing. No larvum, no intricate orb web, no chrysalis, but she decides. I thought I'd like to read something a little different flavor, considering that Mother's Day is coming. So this is called Peeled Grapes. I remember when I was first writing, my effort, which I thought was the job of an apprentice or would-be apprentice writer, was to figure out what we were supposed to write the poems about, and then figure out how we were supposed to write them, and then do it. And I think we all have had the experience of letting a lot of weird poems, weird being in weird and wonderful poems. I think this one's mostly weird, but the subject, anyway, is one of those little things that I would have thought, let's see, should I write a poem about peeled grapes? I don't think so. Peeled grapes. When I call my mother on Mother's Day, I thank her again for making me and for lamb chops, for smocked dresses, for Buster Brown Mary Janes, my metatarsals blue in the radiation box. She laughs. She loves this. She says, I hope you haven't forgotten that I peeled you grapes when you were sick. You what? When you were sick, I would give you a bowl of peeled, chilled grapes. She giggles. I cannot see it. My mother giving me a cold bowl of eyeballish glitter. And then I can see it is a Pyrex dish. There is chill and light and time and work all over the place. Ovals of pallid mesh. Flay to cheer me up, her labor turned to my little joy. It is true she tied me to a chair one day, but she brought me alphabet soup. It is true she was hairbrush wild and lay on top of me, poor dotty soul, for me to pray with her while she cried on me. But my mother, with her long, entranced, erotic fingernails, peeled grapes for me. She did not mean it, but she said it. Be yourself. I teach at two places at New York University Graduate School in creative writing, and then with our students from the creative writing program at a hospital for the severely disabled on Roosevelt Island, a public 900-bed public city hospital. And we're always talking there about subjects that we're moved to write about, but we aren't sure other people are moved to hear about them. And the whole question of that, it seems to me by now that we often will think that what should be done is what has been done, as I mentioned before. And certainly for some of the people at the hospital writing, it's hard for them to believe that others who are not in the same tough, challenging situation that they're in really want to think about it. So we have lots of dialogue back and forth about that. I think we don't really, in a way, choose our subjects for our poems, but I like, one of the things I like about getting older is knowing that I don't know what's going to happen next, and that the young ones are the ones who are, that no one knows what poetry is, no one knows, and that we find out as each generation writes it. So I write a lot about family, and I think partly that may, in my generation, a lot of people do, have something to do with how little happened to have been written about family until that I'm thinking of, about a generation before mine, family, community, close, personal portraits. I'm thinking of writers like Galway Connell and Gwendolyn Brooks and W.D. Snodgrass and so many of my teachers. So this is called The Falls. He reached out a long arm and grasped the hem of my undershirt. It seemed to happen slowly, almost casually. The small child floating away from the shore of the river, the father angling an elegant arm out and hooking the tail tip of her undershirt just before she enters the vector that draws to the center and hurtles to the head of the falls. We were in a river in the air, a celestial river. I did not know they hated each other yet, and the current whisked my feet up off the bottom. I began to make my own way away from the family, and my father stretched a shapely, lean arm and plucked me back. I don't know if the falls was Yosemite or Bridal Veil or Nevada, but I could have been their middle child who died. I would have bobbed to the middle and been rushed to the curved edge of the world, and then in a braid of white water and crush of air, gone down to the roar. It shocks me how glad I am her mouth did not fill with water, her heart stop mid-falls in shock, her shinbone ulna patella coccyx crack. I love her little skull. I cherish it. I caress it with my palm. And I love that young father who easily, slowly snatched her back to her place, dead center in that family. No one would have written of them. They would have died unsung, and they would have preferred that. But my sperm king fished me back and gave me to my mother to strip and towel dry, to burnish. We also often talk about mysteriousness in poems. Many poets have a capacity for mysteriousness, and others are more fearful of it. So I wanted to, since I'm the fearful kind, I wanted to read a somewhat more mysterious poem. It's a short poem called The Stranger. All day I had a feeling I had met someone. Someone I had wanted to meet and been afraid to meet. Someone important, maybe foreign, or someone I had thought dead and then seen alive. The night before, I had seen Jesus's bearded face on the ceiling, within the curves of plaster vine coil, as if I were looking at some small washed area of earth or water, or the first clean clay, as if I were seeing the blankness of a good human, the desirelessness of a reliable parent. But it was not that. Whom had I found who had been lost to me? I could not think. And then I remembered the round, plump, woven silver mirror I had held this bright morning between my legs. I had seen, for the first time, myself face to feral face. I say it's mysterious as if no one knows what it's about. It's a mysterious poem. Spiritual. It must be spiritual. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes when I'm on a plane going to a reading, I work on a new poem, if you can see what that means. And I'd like to read this, though. I'll have to turn it to the side at some point. It's called Familius. Familius. As in Pater Familius, but without the Pater. Familius. In the evenings, during the cocktail hour, my mother's new husband would sometimes inspect the troops. "Your mother has the best fanny in the family," he would announce to my sister and me, at first in our late teens, and then through our 20s and 30s and 40s. "Turn around," he'd cry out. "Turn around." We wouldn't turn around, but he'd say, "Your mother has the nicest little ass in the house." Our mother would smile and writhe a little, cast down her eyes and laugh. "And let's look at those legs," he'd shout. And she'd flash her fleshless matchsticks. "Your mother has the only decent legs in this home," he'd growl. Calfless, assless, our mother would twinkle. She'd humple as if to wriggle a little more out of him. She'd bask her gas blue eyes at us. I'd smile, a big, good sport. And when I'd pass him next, maybe in the hall near the grandfather clock, he'd embrace me as if to say, "No hard feelings." And he'd hit me quite hard on the buttocks two or three times. I felt it was to make my body shake so the tremors would jolt through him. When he did it, he bared his teeth and laughed very loud, and his eyes shone as I otherwise never saw them shine, like eyes of devils and Nazis in horror comic books. Then it was over for a while. He'd freshen his scotch and just top hers up a little. And then, if we were lucky, he'd show us his backwards curled Hohenzollern thumb. "Go on, touch it, touch it." These were people who did not know any better, who once they found each other were happy and felt for the first time as if they belonged on earth, maybe owned it and every creature on it. And this is called 41, Alone, No Gerbil. Suddenly I realize there's no one else in the house. No buck-tooth mouth pulls at a silver teat. No hairy mammal runs on a treadmill. Charlie is dead, the last of our children's half-children. When my girl found him lying sideways, transmogrified backwards from a living body into a bolt of rodent bread, she turned her back on early motherhood and went on single with nothing. Crackers, Fluffy, Pretzel, Biscuit, Charlie, buried on the little farm we bought so she would know nature. Well, now she knows it, and it sucks. All she loves, mobile and needy, has gone down stiff and indifferent. She will not adopt again, though she cannot have children. Her body's still a clear, pliant blueprint for a woman's body. So now everything stops for a while. Now I must wait about 10 years to hear in this house again the small, powerful call of a young animal. I'll read two or three more poems. What is the earth? The earth is a homeless woman. Or the earth's home is the atmosphere. Or the atmosphere is the earth's clothing, layers and layers of it. She wears all of it. The earth is a homeless woman. Or the atmosphere is the earth's cocoon. She spun herself. The earth is a larvum. Or the atmosphere is the earth's skin. Earth and atmosphere, one homeless woman. Or her orbit is the earth's home. Or the path of her orbit is just her path. The earth is a homeless woman. Or the gutter of the earth's orbit is her circle of hell, the circle of the homeless. But the earth has a place around the fire, the hearth of our star. The earth is at home. The earth is home to the homeless. For food and warmth and shelter and health, they have earth and fire and air and water. For home, they have the elements they are made of, as if each homeless woman were the earth, made of milk and grain, like Ceres, as if she could eat herself, as if the human were a god who could eat the earth, a god of homelessness. These days, whenever I see large breasts on a small woman these days, my mouth falls open slightly. If she's walking down the street toward me, it's a little painful to see her pass. Once I heard myself very quietly moan. And on a train that time, she couldn't have been more than 20, tall and willowy. The motion of the train jiggled her breasts steadily, like two panfuls of water. I watched them slosh in their tight containers, and a great sadness came over me. I am so tired and thirsty. I want to suck sweet, hot milk with the salt silk of the human mother along my cheek. I want to be a baby. I want to be small and naked, or with a dry diaper, in loving arms, with a nipple in my mouth. I want to work it gently in its lax nursing state with my gums. I do not want teeth yet, not even the day stars of teeth to be. I want to be soft bone, bendable, as if I had come out of the womb, maybe not days before, but a couple of weeks. I want to be a capable baby, conscious of bliss, of the new milk streaming out of the breast like the music of the spheres. And I don't want it to be my mother. I want to start over. And I'll close with this poem, which is called The Knowing. Afterwards, when we have slept, paradise combed and woken, we lie a long time looking at each other. I do not know what he sees, but I see eyes of surpassing tenderness and calm, a calm like the dignity of matter. I love the open ocean blue-gray-green of his iris. I love the curve of it against the white. The curve, the sight of which has caused me to come when he's quite still, deep inside me. I have never seen a curve like that, except the earth from outer space. I don't know where he got his kindness, without self-regard, almost without self, and yet he chose one woman instead of the others. By knowing him, I get to know the purity of the animal which mates for life. Sometimes he is slightly smiling, but mostly he just gazes at me gazing, his entire face lit. I love to see it change if I cry. There is no worry, no pity, a graver radiance. If we are on our backs, side by side, with our faces turned fully to face each other, I can hear a tear from my lower eye hit the sheet, as if it is an early day on earth. and then the upper eye's tears braid and sluice down through the lower eyebrow like the invention of farming, irrigation, a non-nomadic people. I am so lucky that I can know him. This is the only way to know him. I am the only one who knows him. When I wake again, he is still looking at me as if he is eternal. For an hour we wake and doze, and slowly I know that though we are sated, though we are hardly touching, this is the coming the other brought us to the edge of. We are entering deeper and deeper, gaze by gaze, this place beyond the other places, beyond the body itself. We are making love. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon Alls, for a superb evening, a beautiful reading, wonderful poetry. Thanks so very much. And I have an announcement to make. That is that there will be a reception for the poet at the Cliff Dwellers Club, which is a top orchestra hall across the street, starting at about 8 o'clock. And there is an entrance fee for this. It's a donation for the Poetry Center of $20. And we'll see you all here next season, I hope. And we have some wonderful programs that we're planning for you. This is the close now of our 20th season, and it couldn't have had a better closing reading. Thank you so much again.